Hello, everybody. Welcome to Health Chatter. Today's show is on a tough subject, Alzheimer's. And there's a lot to talk about. We have a great guest. Stay tuned. I'll introduce her in just a minute. We have a great crew that helps us do these shows and get them out to you, the listening audience, in great form. Maddie Levine Wolf, who actually did the background research for this show. So, Maddie, thank you for that. And she's also one of our recorders for our shows. Aaron Collins, DeAndre Howard, also our great researchers, along with Sheridan Nygaard. Matthew Campbell is our production person that gets out all the shows to you in beautiful form with a little bit of music attached to it. We also have I have a great colleague, two great colleagues, Clarence Jones and Barry Baines, who help us get information out to you in some kind of a logical order based on all the things that are going on in health. Clarence has been with the show since day one. Barry's been with us as our medical advisor for about a little over a year now. So thanks to both of you. It's great having you as well. Human Partnership, HUEMAN Partnership, is our sponsor for our shows. You can check them out at humanpartnershipalliance.org. HUEMAN partnershipalliance.org. Check us out at healthchatterpodcast.com, where you can see all, listen to all the shows or read them in transcript form, and also delve into some of the research that we provide for all of you. So thanks again to all of you. So today, Alzheimer's. And wow, there's a lot that's going on in this field. And we have a wonderful guest with us, Patty Takawira, who I've known for a while. she's truly a dear colleague. Patty and I were, she worked with me in the cardiovascular unit when she first started at the Minnesota Department of Health. But now at the Department of Health, she leads the Aging and Healthy Communities Unit within the Center for Health Promotion. Works with a small but mighty team, as she describes it, at MDH, passionate about advancing health equity, which we're going to get into as it relates to Alzheimer's, for sure. Her work focuses on collaborating with statewide partners to create solutions to help reduce dementia risk. She's got a wonderful family, and I remember fondly her kids coming into my office, and I was always giving them a little piece of candy. But I'm sure they've grown up into wonderful, wonderful children. So thanks, Patty, for being with us. By the way, Patty, she's got some really great, great talent. And not only is she a good community health-oriented person, but she's an excellent grant writer too. Boy, we really appreciated her writing skills when I was at the health department. So thank you for connecting with all of us in the healthcare arena, and thanks for being with us today. So, all right, Alzheimer's. All right, so let's talk about, we're going to be talking about it, I think, from kind of like a medical perspective and also a public health perspective. So let's start it out this way, Patty. Obviously, you're at the State Health Department. So let's focus specifically on the types of things that you do as it relates to Alzheimer's with that public health lens on.
Yeah. And I don't know if you remember, Stan, but we didn't just work together. You actually hired me.
Well, yeah.
And now that I'm thinking about it, Clarence was the first person I really met with in my role at MDH.
Really?
Yeah. I went to Southside and we connected around the CDH grant, the Clippers and Curls grant.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. Long time ago. Great history, huh? Yeah. But you are a gem. So, all right. So now Alzheimer's, tell me, let public health, from a public health perspective, give it that kind of insight.
Right. So, from a public health perspective, we're trying to approach dementia in a more upstream way. So, and this research is, relatively new, but 45% of dementia risk factors are potentially modifiable, and that research keeps growing and expanding. Because that's like a relatively new concept that this. You know, there's something people can do to potentially influence the trajectory. It's not necessarily just fated. So communicating that is one of the biggest pieces of our work right now. And what we've found and are realizing more and more every day that is that the way that we need to do that is with strong partnerships. With community partners who can engage trusted messengers to communicate that. So that's one of the areas. Another area is promoting earlier detection and diagnosis. And we could talk about that probably the entire time because it's just so important, not only because of emerging treatments that may require the person to be at an earlier stage of dementia to be able to take advantage of those, but also just to better equip their loved ones and remain in the driver's seat for as long as possible for their own life. So there's more than just kind of the medical treatment side of it. There are ways to live a quality life, and it's not, and there's potentially ways to help delay decline if you get, a plan in place early and kind of understand what the treatment options are. So I would say those are the two kind of biggest areas of our work at MDH is really advocating for system changes in those areas, working with partners to spread awareness. And then just trying to collaborate across statewide partners to kind of identify where there's alignment and get more done together.
It's notable for sure. Hold on, Barry, one sec. I want to make sure that our listening audience understands specifically the distinction between dementia and Alzheimer's. Oftentimes, when we're talking about Alzheimer's, we're kind of talking about both of those at the same time. So maybe you can touch on that a little bit.
Do you want Barry to touch on that?
No, you go
Oh yeah. Well,
ahead.
dementia is an umbrella term that describes a set of symptoms, and Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia. So when we're talking about Alzheimer's, we're just being more specific.
So Barry, I'm sure in the work that you did, you were involved with Alzheimer's and or dementia,
Right.
but
Well,
you go
yeah.
ahead.
Actually, that's why I was just raising my hand is that, we're kind of chomping at the bit to get into hearing all the stuff that Patty, is doing and all those good things. And again, I think for our listening audience and also for our panel members who were in the podcast, it never hurts to kind of go over things, about specifically the difference between dementia, Alzheimer's dementia, and of course, Patty, you hit the nail right on the head. The idea that dementia is the broad umbrella, and then underneath it, there's a number of different kinds of dementia, of which Alzheimer's dementia is is the most common. So I just wanted to jump in and make sure that we at least had a basic leveling of the playing field, so that we don't get confused between Alzheimer's disease, which is really Alzheimer's dementia, and so to be clear about that, and that's just where I was going. To your point, I dealt with a lot of, as a family doctor. Again, I was one of those womb to tomb doctors, delivering babies all the way to the end of life, where a lot of my care in the last 20 years of my practice was in hospice and end of life care. And over time, what wound up happening is I would say the majority of the hospice patients that we wound up having reflected the commonality of Alzheimer's dementia when it got very advanced. That became one of the most common diagnoses in end of life care in hospice. It was end stage dementia, of which Alzheimer's was the most common.
You
So
know, I
it's, and you know, it's very difficult because there's very a lot of things with families and how do you go about it. And you know, in the at the end of life component, you can't get upstream. You know, and that's why. So I'm like really, you know, excited and interested to hear about some of the things that Patty's doing. I don't know if I'm getting to your specific questions or queries of me, Stan. So feel free to keep poking the bear
All
if
right.
you need to.
Clarence, go ahead.
Yeah. So I'm glad you asked that question about the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia. Because one of the stories I always talk about is the fact that, you know, in thinking about this particular topic, I said I wouldn't mind getting Alzheimer's, but I didn't want dementia, you know. And it was that kind of thing where, you know, you don't understand, you know, you hear certain words and it just starts to, you know, cause you to do. I do not want either one of them, but I'm just saying in terms of myths and understanding. The other thing too that I think is important is that I'm also involved in a group that's called HATS. It's Healthy Aging Through Senior Years, and it's taking a look at Alzheimer's through a study, because you know in my community, I'm an African American. In my community, so many times the impact of Alzheimer's or dementia was often played off as, oh, they're just getting old, you know. And you know, so they would do some interesting things and we would just say, oh, that's just grandma, that's the way she is, you know, kind of thing. In fact, quite honestly, I didn't like my grandmother, you know, but as I think about it now, I think it was because she had Alzheimer's, you know what I mean, because she was not, she, you know, she, I mean, I'm being totally serious here, because I mean, I think one of the things about this particular disease is that because we don't understand it, or we're not familiar with it, we assume so many things about it. And people, if they don't tell you, if they're not informed themselves, then it doesn't help the relationships in the family. And I've actually seen examples of people whose families were torn apart because of this disease. And I think it's one of the reasons why I'm really glad that we're talking about it, because it is important for us to understand that it happens, and that it happens not just with old folk, but it could also happen with middle-aged people. You know what I mean? And so to enter this conversation, Patty, I thank you for that, because I think it's important to just kind of be honest about this, because it's a very serious thing, and I understand that it's happening more and more now. So anyway, so that's my opening salvo.
All right,
I
so
think that's
Patty,
super important, yeah.
you know, it's like I'll use myself as an illustration. It's like I'm forgetful. You know, I forget certain things. It's just like,
Me too.
it's just like I get up from my chair and I go do something, then I realize, wait a minute. What did I get up from my chair to just do? You know, it's like, so there's the part of the question I have is what's normal versus what's abnormal? What should we just normally expect as we get older? Maybe it's just because life is becoming more complicated and you know, we You know, our minds get all scattered and everything. But what's normal versus, wait a minute, this is something that you really need to pay attention to now.
Right. And I think this is really kind of step one, I think, for both providers and the general public to understand is when to, you know, get to that next step of talking to your provider about what's going on. So a typical age-related change would be something like missing a monthly payment or forgetting which day it is and remembering it later, or losing things from time to time, forgetting what word you're trying to say. And I get these examples from the Alzheimer's Association because they're really good at promoting this message about what is normal aging and what are signs and symptoms of Alzheimer's or dementia. So those are typical age-related changes, or if you're a busy mom, I would say that those are typical for me too. But something like difficulty having a conversation, losing track of like what season it is, or not, you're noticing that your loved one's not able to manage their budget, or even they're doing something that, I know, one of our colleagues at the Public Health Center of Excellence on early detection was talking us through, the idea of using tools like the MiniCog. Those are great, but also if you're, in the home of a loved one or a community member who's been like cooking rice every day their entire life, and all of a sudden they're looking really confused about how to go about this thing that they have always, that is a concerning. So I think it's really, how is it, is it poor judgment and decision making? Is it, how common, or how often is it happening? Is it like, oh, I kind of forgot for a second, but then I remembered, or literally an inability to retrace your steps? Like, you don't know, you're confused, you get lost and you're in the car and you're just like lost and you don't know how to get back. So I would say that those are kind of the differences, but it's a little nuanced. So it makes sense if you feel concerned. So we track this in the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, BRFSS, as Stan. There's a question about subjective cognitive decline. So this is like people feel like they're experiencing cognitive decline. And the really interesting thing about that is that about half of the folks who report subjective cognitive decline are between the ages of 45 and 64. So when I first started looking into that data with Renee Kidney at MDH, it's like, whoa. I mean, I don't think people know this, Renee. Like, I don't think people know that it's not just happening in the 65 plus age range that people are having these symptoms, but that's when they're getting missed. And only 4 in 10 of those folks experiencing subjective cognitive decline had talked with a healthcare provider about it. So now you can see, like, it's really both sides that need to understand how to initiate the conversation. So there's just so much work to do from a public health perspective. It's both really concerning and kind of like the opportunity is also exciting, which I think is why I've stayed in this role doing this work, because it's like a big problem to solve, which I just keeps me going, I think.
There are other things that, and Barry, maybe you can talk about this a little bit. As people age, and correct me if I'm wrong, but they have a tendency to remember long-term memory stuff, happened, a while back, versus, something that might have happened just yesterday. Is there some credence to that overall, short-term, long-term distinction here? Barry, you're on mute. Barry, you're on mute.
Read my lips. No.
Raise your lips. Okay. Yeah.
Read your lips. Okay. Was that short term or long term memory? Okay,
yeah, right. That's an example of short term memory. I didn't
Exactly.
remember
Yeah,
that
leave
I
it
had
on.
my mute button on. But it is prime, mostly a short term memory piece that we see more of, and oftentimes some longer term memory, does remain intact there. But I think what's very interesting, Patty, is what you said, what those studies showed between the 45 and 65, population. I mean, some subjective decline happens, oftentimes forgetting things. If you just don't get too anxious about it, oftentimes it'll come back to you. That you will, it's not like it's lost forever. That usually does come back. But I this is just something I wonder about in the younger population. The reason why they may not bring it up is that people are very fearful of getting dementia. That and for the older population, Clarence is sort of like what you were saying. It's sort of as you get older, it's more expected, and it's more accepted in that way. But when you're younger, I think there's a bigger fear. Plus, I know that there has been a marked increase in early onset dementia. I don't know if the some of the studies sort of looked at that, but actually personal experience, I've had three friends of mine whose spouses all developed early onset dementia like in their late 50s, early 60s, and that's again, it's not necessarily Alzheimer's, but it's another piece of this dementia puzzle, that's very, that's very scary and very devastating. So,
True.
yeah. Clarence.
Yeah, I want to make a clarification. It wasn't my grandmother, it was my great grandmother.
Oh.
I want to be clear.
One generation removed.
One generation beyond. Okay. But anyway, the other part though is I had an aunt who developed early onset, and she had when she's like 45. I mean, so and I did, again, the doctor said this, but I just didn't. I had no idea what he was talking about. And I think that part of what is important today is that we're talking about this in a way so that when doctors mention something like that, then you kind of got you may have some familiarity with it. But I wanted to ask Patty this, chronic diseases. What kind of chronic diseases impact Alzheimer's, or is it something that just has no direct input or impact by about our physical health?
Yeah, so this is a great question, and it's like multidirectional. So one of the, I don't know, I kind of refer to it as like the biggest bang for your buck for dementia risk reduction is controlling midlife hypertension. And this has been noted in the, so in 2020, The Lancet came out with this concept of like the modifiable risk factors. And then another report came out in 2024 that added some additional risk factors that were considered modifiable. But midlife hypertension, controlling hypertension, and then also preventing obesity and diabetes and type 2 diabetes. And so of course there's vascular dementia. So it's not just like you're getting Alzheimer's disease, but there's other types of dementia, like vascular dementia, that kind of the heart brain connection is really, really important. So I think, and then people living with dementia also typically experience multiple chronic conditions. And have to manage those as well, which obviously is more complicated when you're experiencing dementia. And then I would add that dementia caregivers are also experiencing higher rates of chronic conditions and depression. And, so there's just a lot to think about with chronic disease and this issue. I have an analogy for the memories, the short-term, long-term memories that you mentioned from, I think I learned this in Dementia Friends Champion training, but the analogy is like a bookshelf. So your most resilient, I guess, memories are at the bottom, the sturdy part of the bookshelf, and those are kind of like the last to go. So your more short-term memories are kind of at that top, less sturdy part. So thinking about it that way kind of helped it make sense to me. And then about stigma. So when we were working on our dementia strategic plan, this is like the importance of community input, because I don't think we would have teased out this nuance without really working with the community to consider kind of our biggest priorities in the state. But there's discrimination, which is kind of like your dementia-friendly community work is really working to support, right? Like making your community dementia-friendly, signage, support for people living with dementia and caregivers. But then there's reducing stigma, and that's a different concept. And so we have both of those as key strategies within our educate and activate category of the dementia strategic plan, because the stigma issue is so strong and really nuanced across different cultural communities. So it just, it needs to be addressed in a really culturally specific way through trusted messengers, which I think will resonate with Clarence. So yeah, I just wanted to mention that too. It
So let
all
me,
changes.
there's, like when you go for a physical exam to your primary care provider, they do this little quick screening thing, right? Where it says, okay, Stan, remember these three words, table, chair, and roof or something. Okay, and then they have you do something else. Okay, and then they come back. Okay, what were the three words? Is that a screener? Is that truly a screening mechanism to try to get a handle on forgetfulness, dementia, whatever?
Yeah, I think it's like a brief cognitive screen. One issue is that there's this kind of the annual wellness exam that is reimbursed through Medicare, which is actually, from what I mean, this is kind of where I get out of my own element, but I'm pretty sure that the reimbursement rate's pretty good, but it's underutilized. But in that visit, it incorporates a brief cognitive screen. I think regardless of symptoms. So that is one, that's something that I've been thinking about is why and how, why is it underutilized and what would help people understand how to utilize that visit, or how do we work with providers to what's an efficient way to utilize the annual wellness visit to think about early detection.
It's tough. You brought up also, Patty, and I want to touch on this a little bit too. Caregivers. It's like, oh my gosh, I had a very, very dear colleague who's actually my doctoral advisor who came down with Alzheimer's. And to be honest with you, that was the first time I actually saw somebody going through it over a period of time. And I remember distinctly being in their home and noticing that there were like post-it notes just about everywhere, to remind, where to go to get a cup or where to go to get your medicines. So let's touch on this a little bit. This I'll be bold by saying the stress and strain that it puts on caregivers or your loved ones. So how from a public health standpoint do we deal with that? Are we addressing that? Or are we just making it known that there is?
Well, in Minnesota, the University of Minnesota actually supports. So our work on dementia at MDH is partially funded through the BOLD Act, Building Our Largest Dementia Infrastructure. And through that funding, there's also three centers of excellence to support state grantees. The University of Minnesota operates as the BOLD Center of Excellence on Dementia Caregivers. And they're building out a ton of resources. And I think a while back, there was this campaign that Wilder led about kind of like helping people identify as a caregiver, because that's not necessarily how people identify, but that's sort of how the resources are communicated. So if you are just kind of finding yourself in this role and it just feels like your familial duty and it's not all negative, right? It's not like, oh, the burden, the like it's hard and it feels hard, but you might not identify it with it being a burden. Just like culturally, that might not make any sense. So I think the way, just like how we're talking about risk factors or earlier detection and diagnosis, it needs to be kind of a culturally community-specific approach to connecting caregivers to resources. And they really need resources. Like, but
Yeah.
they're all they're and the other thing is that there are a lot of resources. So this is where kind of our public health role in building clinical community linkages comes in, because if the provider, the care team really needs to know what the resources are locally, culturally, and have a way to identify that people are a caregiver for one. So that could be, making sure that that caregiver is, because sometimes they're not really asked any questions in the visit. And, even if you're like that sandwich generation caregiver and you're in your own primary care visit, wouldn't it be good to know someone's dealing with that and that it
Yeah.
is a social determinant of health for chronic disease, and that making sure that they're getting resources that they need. So in my ideal world, like there's these awesome connections happening between community resources and care teams, and then we could have a bunch of conversations about the community health worker role and building on that.
Clarence.
Thanks, Stan, for that question, because that was where I was going to go about this caregiver piece. Because, I tell the story that I was a caregiver of a caregiver, and that wore me out.
Whoa,
Yeah, I mean,
yes.
and if I would have had somebody else close in my life, they'd have been worn out too, because that was just one of those things. But I think that you asked a question about, why people don't talk about it more, why people don't talk about it. I'm doing health screenings on a regular basis, and there is a Volunteers of America is right next door to us. And then when you go when people come up to the table in that age range, and you start talking to them, they'll say something like, "Oh, I'm good." It's like, I'm not going even into this conversation. I'm just good. You know what I mean? And then they forget what they were doing. But I'm just saying that I think that in this particular case, it's people are afraid of finding out what could be going on with me. And I also think that sometimes people don't know who they can count on to help them if they're going through this process. So I think that there's a couple different things that are happening here. Is that, if your life is all scattered and you think that you're losing your memory and stuff like that, who do I go to? You know what I mean? So those are the kinds of things that I'm saying to answer your question. What I'm seeing in community is that there's a lot of stuff that's happening. And so how do you, so there's a lot of stuff that's happening.
Barry, go ahead.
So I was curious about some of the links, and again, personal experience. My mother-in-law, before she passed, had what was most likely Alzheimer's dementia at that time. And one of the resources that we found pretty helpful, again, I'm not wearing my doctor hat here, I'm wearing my normal person hat, was the Alzheimer's Association. And they were very helpful, both with information and advice and strategies and things like that. And I'm just wondering how integrated the Alzheimer's Association as a resource for the community at large is, and how people can better tap into that resource.
Yes, I was going to say, in the show notes or at some point in this episode, that we really need to point people to the 24/7 Alzheimer's Association hotline, because that is like a one-stop shop to get connected to support. So even if care teams are just aware of two things in Minnesota specifically, it would be the 24/7 Alzheimer's Association hotline, which they'll help get people connected to local resources. And then the other is the senior linkage line, because the senior linkage line can connect people to caregiver consultants, which is a program through Department of Human Services. So there are two really good kind of high level, like first points of contact that are really useful to know about, both general public and providers. Then, right, then there's the issue of, is there a more, especially for communities that are kind of marginalized and aren't, maybe trusting of these, unless it's like in their cultural, in their language, or it's more of a cultural resource, like then they're going to probably feel more comfortable going to where they always go, which is, maybe their community center or whatever. People have their trusted places where they go. So we need to be able to, we need to equip those places with accurate information so that it can be disseminated in the right language, in the right way. And we have a bunch of partners doing that work, which is so exciting, especially Clarence, you mentioned BOA, and they are, they've worked with us for a while on this. They have a brain health education series. They support caregivers. They have a mobile memory clinic, which is the only mobile memory care clinic in the country, as far as I know, or at least it was, back in 2020. I'm guessing it still is. But they're also like equipping barbers and hairstylists to be able to share accurate information about dementia for just the general community, caregivers, because they're a trusted source of information and they're seeing people all the time. So it's not just about, it's about being dementia friendly, like being able to support someone who's ex living with dementia to be able to get their hair done, but also you've got caregivers there. You've got people coming in talking about taking care of their loved one, and they don't know what to do next. And so that's a really cool project. It kind of has the, made me think of the Clipper and Curls, and
I
that
think,
goes back a ways.
I think one of the things for me, and I'm glad we're talking about this. And I know that the topic sometimes when we start talking about different groups and talk about different strategies that we have to use, this is a very, very impactful issue that's going to affect us one way or another economically. You know what I mean? And that's the one thing that sometimes we don't talk about, but it's true. I mean, in families where you have these issues, I mean, it could hinder families from working,
Definitely.
or it hinder families who don't have insurance, I mean, and if you let it go long enough, then all of a sudden it still becomes an economic issue because somebody's going to have to take care of it. You know what I mean? So I think that part of it, we never lose the humanity in talking about this topic, but I think we also have to be honest that this is a very, very important issue for us. Individually as well as a group.
For our listening audience, we've got some really, really good background research, so I really encourage you to check out our website. But this is these are things that really kind of hit me as I was reading this. Alzheimer's disease was officially listed as the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. This is back in 2019. And actually it dropped to seventh when COVID hit the scene. More than 11 million Americans provide unpaid care for a family member or friend with dementia. That to me is pretty disturbing. And then, of course, not, this is getting into the equity arena now, which I really want to kind of touch base with. Black Americans are about two times more likely than white Americans to have Alzheimer's. Hispanics are about 1.5 times. By 2050, in 25 years, Asian Americans are projected to comprise nearly 8% of those 85, 65 and older, that, and then they're at a higher risk for that. I mean, it goes on and on. Almost two-thirds of those living with Alzheimer's are women, which was a surprise to me. I didn't know that. And so it's like, and then the other thing, and then Patty, you can chime in on this. You know that we've, I've always, been aware of the Stroke Belt of the United States, and it's really interesting when you look at the United at the United States. There's a higher incidence of Alzheimer's. At least it appears to be higher in that swath of the United States that runs from, like, shall we say, like from Washington, D.C., south and then west towards Texas. Okay. So has there been any, okay, so all these data points, comment on them a little bit. Are we seeing environmental things? What's going on here?
Well, it's a higher disease rates, but it's also lower diagnosis and later
Ah,
diagnosis. And so
good point. Good point.
that's and I think this is what really concerns me is that if there are going to be new emerging treatments that can, change the trajectory or delay cognitive decline. And then, by the way, if you have mild cognitive impairment, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to develop into dementia. And so I think that's a really important point to make. You can have MCI, and you can just have MCI, or, I mean, you have a higher risk of developing dementia. But it's really important to identify mild cognitive impairment. So because of all the other, what we know about discrimination and marginalization, people of color in the healthcare system, like same goes for this topic. And we need to make sure that we're working with all these different sectors to increase earlier diagnosis. Because I think that's maybe our key to changing, or like I feel like the disparity is just going to widen
Yeah.
if people are getting, as research, as research and treatments develop, if people are being treated at the earlier stages of their disease because they're, getting diagnosed, then what? It's just going to widen. So we really need to, I think the earlier detection and diagnosis is an area that an area of impact that we should focus on as a state. I'm not sure
So
about
when
the
you
connection with the, like the belt that you talked about, but when you
Yeah.
think about the connection between, that heart brain, vascular
Right.
pathway, it just kind of makes sense, right?
Right. So, all right. You mentioned at the very top of the show that we're dealing with a kind of an equity issue here. So we're seeing populations, okay, putting on our public health hats for a minute, we're seeing populations that are higher risk. So help our audience understand, why is the Black community at a higher risk? Why is the Hispanic community at a higher risk? Why are women at higher risk? Has there been any indications or any research that's done that might shed some light on this?
I have some good resources for you to peruse later. Us Against
Okay.
Alzheimer's is one that has a really specific focus on Black and Latino communities.
Yeah.
And they've got some good, papers and documents and really just good
Good. We'll
stuff.
get that on our website.
They actually have a Center for Brain Health Equity, which is really cool. So lots of national partners thinking about this. But when you think about like hypertension rates in our state, we know that they're much higher for, all chronic disease rates are just higher for those population groups. And so I think, knowing how integrated everything is going to increase risk. So
I think the thing that we talk about is hypertension and stress. Those are higher in those populations. I mean, and it just it, you know, it's not a, I think when we get to this kind of conversations, we don't have to be timid about it. There are just some real factors that are there in these communities. There's higher rates of stress. There's higher rates of hypertension, higher chronic diseases, and all of these things impact Alzheimer's. You know, so it's a, you know, it's a fact and not necessarily so much an emotional thing. So,
I'd be remiss not to, I guess, bring in a little bit of the politics of the day, unfortunately. So I saved this from the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and it came out on Friday, March 21st, a couple days ago. Blocked funding stalls key Alzheimer's drugs. Now, as I read through our background research, right now there isn't a treatment or there isn't a particular drug. But, if we're stalling these things, if truly if we're stalling these things like Alzheimer's drug treatment, it's like where are we headed then?
Well, and Stan, one of the biggest issues regarding the populations mentioned that are experiencing health inequities, they're underrepresented in research, like big time underrepresented in research. So if we're saying, oh, we can't prioritize certain populations in research or it's going to get defunded,
It's mind-boggling.
it's not the right approach because we know that that's the issue. And rightly so, right? People aren't going to enroll in research studies without a lot of support and understanding of the impact it could have, given the history, that we have in this country around that. So,
So you understand my angst.
I do. I do. It's
You live it every day.
Well, the
All
one thing
right.
I can say on a positive note is that my hunch is that this issue is really bipartisan because it affects all
Everybody.
communities. I mean, there's health inequities, but people are affected by this. And everyone you talk to has a story about knowing a caregiver, being a caregiver. And there's this is the Rosalind Institute for Caregivers. I'm not saying the name right. But the quote is like, you're either going to be a caregiver, need a caregiver, have been a caregiver. I think there's a fourth one I'm forgetting. But like the point is, there's no escaping this, right? So I think it hits home for both sides of the aisle. And I mean, I think that's something that we can leverage.
To be honest with you, whether it's Alzheimer's or it's heart disease or it's diabetes or it's cancer, believe me, all these diseases don't look at you and ask you whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or whatever. They just say, okay, we'll just keep doing our stuff, and so that's why health in and of itself is affects us all. Go ahead, Barry.
Oh, no, I just wanted to again reinforce and build on what Patty was saying. And then I think when you look demographically with the population, eventually I think we have to hit a some kind of tipping point, because you're either going to have
Or a sweet
Alzheimer's
spot.
or dementia, or you're going to be a caregiver for helping someone with that. And the percentage of the population that will be involved in that, it just so I'm putting on my hopeful hat. Here, and that we will come up with a better way to address this. And it does need to be culturally sensitive because different cultures handle those kind of family dynamic issues in a different way. Ranging from no, we can't do that. So maybe long-term care or memory care, again, if you can afford it, is something. And then other families say, no, this is our grandma or great grandma, and we will take care of them
Right.
as best we can. And one of the issues is that oftentimes people don't know what they don't know, so they don't know what to ask
Right.
about things. And so that's, to me, is the key we have, which is again why I like health chatter so much, is because we're getting people talking about these kind of things. And I think that's has to be one of the first steps, because in communities, you also, it's that trust issue that of a community that really speaks to the pulse of that community and has a better idea of what's going to work in a community
Exactly.
than, someone in another state somewhere.
You know what I think? I think, one of the things when it comes to this kind of thing about, we talk about different groups, even within groups, there are also other groups, subgroups. You know what I mean? You can do things even regionally. There could be a difference in terms of how people handle things. You know what I mean? And so a lot of times when we throw out a word, people automatically assume that it's just those people, but it's also us, because a poor family might handle this topic a whole lot differently than a rich family will. You know what I'm saying? I mean, economics. I mean, so I think that part of what has to be considered is the fact that all of us are going to be impacted by this. Just as your comment a little bit earlier about quoting, it's going to happen to us. I mean, and so we need to be aware of the importance of us addressing the issue. Even though it may not affect you the same way it'll affect somebody else. So that's what I'm hoping that we do. As Barry was saying with health chatters, that at least we enter the conversation to talk about it and do something. So,
And increase awareness about it.
yep.
So, Patty, this has been really good. It's probably, we're only probably touching the tip of the
Oh, for
iceberg here.
sure.
But so for our listening audience, what might be, a good takeaway from your perspective on this subject?
Hey, my big takeaway would be that dementia is not a normal part of aging, right? There are risk factors that influence our risk for dementia. And we didn't really get into the social determinants of health, but some they're modifiable, but obviously there's policy changes that if we don't have a we can say, oh, physical activity is good for your health, right? But we need to actually create an environment in which that's possible. Earlier detection and diagnosis helps families. It helps families understand what to expect. It helps them plan. It helps them identify, if it's malcognitive impairment, why, are there it helps understand what's going on with the person, what treatments are possible, plan for the future. Everyone wants that. I know it's scary, right? But it's better to have a plan. And then another one would be just that, dementia can be detected anywhere. It doesn't need to be in a healthcare office. So we need to equip our community organizations that are trusted across the state to identify signs and symptoms and then have a understanding of what to do next. So getting people connected with the resources that exist and just building that network so that we can all work together to influence, like by 2060, these numbers are supposed to double. What are we gonna do? We have to do something about that. And I can tell you, from a policy perspective, we have a tiny amount of money to support community partners to do this work. So like for an example, we have an Alzheimer's awareness campaign, and we recently put out an RFP, request for proposals for community organizations, and we can fund four, right? There were like 40 applications, 40 proposals. And they were all great. People are ready. And this was like an implementation ready project we were asking them to do with this short time frame. And people like these organizations are ready to go, but they can't just, they need support to be able to do this. So to me, that's like we have the connections and the collaboration. But we need, I think that just more support, is needed to address this topic. And
Well,
then
at the top of the show, I had mentioned that, we're really looking at it from Alzheimer's from different angles, the public health angle, the medical angle, the community angle. And I think we've certainly touched on that in this show. Not in depth, but certainly enough that we hope we've sparked some interest in the subject matter. One thing I can say is that once this show goes out, you can use it for in the
I
at
will.
for, to get the information out to the public in different ways. Last thoughts, Clarence.
Thank you, Patty.
Thank you.
That's all I want to say. Thank you, Patty. It was good.
It's
This
good.
has been
Yeah,
fun.
yeah. Barry, last thoughts.
Thank you, Patty. It was great to meet you. We covered a lot. And again, it's an ongoing conversation. Appreciate
Yes,
your
absolutely.
expertise on this. It was very helpful.
You
And my
too.
thought is beyond, thank you.
Thank you for delving into this subject matter from a public health perspective. You are a true public health gem, and so thank you very, very, very much. You're a great colleague, and thanks for being on the show. For our listening audience, we got an interesting show coming up. Dr. John Finnegan, who used to be the dean of the School of Public Health, is going to be talking about public health. Now what? So stay tuned for that show coming up. That'll be interesting. In the meantime, everybody out there in health chatter land, keep health chatting away.